This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And are you ready to chart your path to financial independence? Of course you are. Well, get started with Portfolio Analyst by Interactive Brokers. Portfolio Analyst lets you consolidate and track and analyze all of your financial accounts on a single powerful dashboard. And the best part, check this out, it's free for everyone. No IBKR account required. Plan for your future with their new retirement planner tailored to your preferences and market assumptions. And you can even unlock deep portfolio insights with comprehensive risk assessments. Drill down into specific metrics like portfolio holdings or your allocation and even performance. Track your performance against more than 300 benchmarks. Plus, manage your portfolios confidently with GIPS verified returns. Sign up for Portfolio Analyst for free at ibkr.com/freepa. It's like freepa. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Big tech making a mess of markets. A new candidate, investors reassessing their holdings. September rate cut probability at 100%? Let's discuss. And our guest today is Howard Silverblatt, Senior Industry Analyst, Index Investment Strategy for S&P Dow Jones Indices. All this and much more on episode number 879 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And just like that, July is coming to a close. Heat index is up, oh my. And you know what else? So is the VIX. Hope you're doing well and faring better financially than you ever have. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and thank you for all your recent comments, your emails, and those of you especially who have recently come in as clients. I appreciate every one of you and every one of our listeners that are out there that have been with us just for, I don't know, how long, how many years is it now? It's going on since about 16, 17 years. Is that right? It's about right. So thank you for very much for being there all along and supporting us in all sorts of ways, but also by just your kindness and your commentary on what we're doing. So we try and we aim to bring you some of the best in financial literacy, education, information, so that you can be on your way to being independent financially in the future. So never an end to the education that we could do in the area of finance, because it's always changing. I mean, it's forever just changing every single day, and this is no difference. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as you know, and you can find out more about me, my firm that I founded, on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Also listen to DH Unplugged with myself and John C. Dvorak on Tuesdays. We go live at 9 p.m. at night Eastern time, but also you can find it just like you find all the other ones on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, anywhere you could Google for that matter, or YouTube now. YouTube. We're on YouTube now as of the last few weeks. So let's talk about what's going on. Big tech, kind of a wreck, right? Kind of a big wreck. Tech wreck? Maybe it's a tech wreck. But why is this going on? Why all of a sudden? What's happening? Well, here we are on the precipice of a slew. We've had a few already, but a slew of these major firms coming out with their earnings. And the truth is, what we're seeing is that over the next few weeks, we have the earnings. We have the CrowdStrike ordeal, not so good, not a real blemish in the area of technology. Earnings from Google came out, not as good as expected. As a matter of fact, some of the ad revenue was disappointing. And as I see it right now, it appears to me that it's just not good enough. The beats are not good enough. They need to be spectacular. They need to be outrageous. Expectations are so high coming into this. We know that. We've seen this. We know that everybody was just totally excited and thinking about all the possibilities and opportunities and this never-ending stream of increased revenue, productivity benefits, margin expansion, all these things that were exciting and in the minds and imagination of investors. And of course, the imaginations of all the blowhards that come on the TVs talking about all these different things about how the endless amount of productivity gains, the endless amount of earnings that will just be growing at some ridiculous amount per year. But that, again, every so often we get disappointment. And that, I think, is what is becoming more obvious from some of the companies that they will do well, but they may not reach these lofty expectations that some of them are putting out. And then when you have a combination of complacency, which we've been discussing for a while, and overvalued names, and those names being a major component of an index, well, what you have is that when something goes a little bit to the downside, it goes down big, just like we saw it moving up. It's a recipe for volatility, and nothing really at this point to be totally freaked out about, because we did see some good numbers out of the banks. And generally speaking, companies are doing better. But we'll talk about that, because I really want to get into the nitty-gritty details of the impact of technology and how indices are constructed in order to have what we're seeing today as this crazy overvaluation based on just a few names. And we're going to get to that with our guest, Howard Silverblatt. Now, as we know it now, even though it was hidden for a while, or at least there was pushback on it, Biden is out, and the presumptive now Democratic candidate is going to be Vice President Harris. And all the odds are a little bit wonky still until we get the official and who the VP is about who's going to win. But things got a little bit nuts because the entire election process was based on the rematch of Trump-Biden. And now this puts it all in his head. And you see some polls coming out, we talked about this on DH Unplugged, that show that Harris has a much better opportunity to beat Trump. Now, I don't know if that was a comparison before or after the abysmal debate, but what we have now is a much different tenor and potential. And investors, what they're doing is trying, which I think is a little silly, but they're trying to handicap, well, what if Trump gets in, and is that good for this sector, that sector? Is it going to be difficult on the restaurant business, the oil business, the fracking? Is it going to be good for corporations with lower taxes? Is it going to be a problem for our deficit? And if Harris gets in, is it going to be an issue with relating to big tech and this? You know, all these things that go on in this analysis. The problem is we don't exactly know, because when Biden was running, we knew what he did when he was president, for good or bad. When Trump was president, we knew what he did, for good or for bad. And that was the matchup for a while. And now all of a sudden you're throwing in uncertainty. And you know, if you've been listening to me for any amount of time, one thing that I can always say is that markets hate is uncertainty. That's why the opportunity to have a Democratic Congress and a Republican president, or more so a Democratic Congress, or pick your poison, Republican, it doesn't matter, but Democratic Congress and a Republican Senate, and you have that lock and that jam, well, that's something that everybody likes, because we know we're not going to have any surprises, just something coming out crazy because there's a checks and balances there. Now, the other thing that we are looking at right now is that the probability of a rate cut in September is booked down on the odds factors at 100%. Yes, you heard me right, 100%. And that is interesting because I don't think that's possible. Unless things really fall apart in a hurry, and we're seeing that, yes, unemployment rates have ticked up a little bit, and we're seeing the housing numbers that have been a little bit soft. Inflation has come down a bit, but the PPI has stayed a little hot. We're going to see some other numbers coming out over the next few weeks that can give us some more just insight into, you know, the manufacturing and the full potential of where the economy is. But right now, what I'm saying is it doesn't seem like a place that the Fed really would like to get involved, because we know for eons, the Fed has tried to stay non-political. uninvolved, at least give that appearance. And if, in fact, they cut before the election, there's going to be a foul called. Penalty. Fed shouldn't get involved in anything with whether they do or not have anything to do with the elections and the outcome. The fact of the matter is it will be perceived that that's what they're doing. Which side does this benefit? I don't know. But the fact is that probably they're thinking it will benefit the Democrats because it happened on their watch when there was before an election when we didn't know the outcome, and they would, you know, say that, look what we're doing. We're lowering rates during our, that'll be used as a campaign item. But I don't know. The way things go, you don't know. Maybe the Trump campaign could turn around and say it was their idea. Who knows? Who knows? Truth is, I just don't think that it's really something that the Fed really wants to get into, even though the market is desperately trying to push the Fed. Desperately trying to push the Fed to do something as soon as possible. So, can't have a conversation these days without including the Fed in it when we talk about investments. So there you have it. All right, let's get to our guest this week. I'm pretty excited because we've had him on many times before, and he has some just a treasure trove of information related to the S&P 500 and other indices that he oversees. And our guest today is Howard Silverblatt. He's a senior industry analyst, index investment strategy for S&P Dow Jones Indices. In addition to general market research and commentary, he's responsible for the statistical analysis of S&P DJIs, the Dow Jones family of U.S. indices, including the world's most followed stock market index, the S&P 500. So in other words, Howard is the keeper of the data. He's been with Standard & Poor's since 1977. He's held various analytic business development and product positions. He's joined back in 1983 as an editor and since received numerous corporate and industry awards. So I'm glad to have him. He's been on plenty of times. Last time was about a year and a half ago. So let's tee it up for Howard. So Howard, thanks for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me in sunny Florida.
Yeah, I know. Welcome to Florida. You've been here, what, 5 years now?
Several years, but I am now permanent down here. I am domiciled. Oh, yeah. I get back to New York a lot, but I've made the move.
Which means that you got a raise. Because you don't have to pay those nasty and pesky state and city
tax. Yeah, those things hit 10% easily, and they go up to 14%.
Right.
But it's the cost of living also is totally different down here. Although Florida does seem to be an expensive state and getting a lot more.
Yes.
But again, it's still worse than say Manhattan.
Yep.
Where I came from.
I have a lot of things to talk to you about. I want to talk about some earnings issues. I want to talk about estimates. I want to see, you know, your thoughts on that because you're the keeper of the info. I know. I get your spreadsheets from time to time that you send me and. I know how much work it is to keep all of that for, you know, eons of time and so many data points. But I want to talk just for a minute about index characteristics, factoring. And I think that S&P was one of the first, maybe they didn't know it was called factoring at the time, but they were the first factor-based index that was not just an average of something. It was based on market cap. How far back does that go?
Into the 1920s. The first S&P market value full composite was the S&P 90 in 1926. Okay. We put it out. Not we. I was not here.
You weren't working there that long.
Not yet. We put it out daily because it was a little bit more complex. You look at the Dow, 1896. You add them up. You divide. There it is. Average. Nice and easy. You can do it. You don't need a calculator. You don't need an abacus. You add up the 30 numbers and divide. The S&P indices, though, are market weighted, as you said. So I need the price. I need the number of shares, the index shares. I need an adjustable divisor that takes care of splits and adds and deletes. And then I have something called float, which we don't even want to get into. It's a lot more complicated, but it reflects more what the market is in there. You know, where is the money? Not all companies are equal, although we do have equal weighted indices, not just S&P, but many companies that you can get. But on a market weighted basis, similar to clients, you know, the bigger ones are more important. and they have a heavier weight. And that's why we see, for example, the power of the Magnificent Seven, or when you look at the top Apple, Microsoft, and NVIDIA, you know, which are over 20% of an index. Three companies, over 20% of 500, they carry so much more weight than the other companies.
And that flows through to all the different statistical information, not only the return. Yeah, but the
earnings, the dividends, the PE ratios, all these things. And it changes the characteristics and what you consider to be valued and overvalued. Are the Magnificent Seven overvalued, undervalued? And how does that affect the other 493? This is not a new situation. Okay, we've had it back in the early 1980s. It was a company called IBM that was coming out with a new product that was supposed to take over the world called PCs. And it accounted for over 6% of the index by itself. And that was unheard of. Mm. We were all freaking out at the time. Yes, I was at S&P in the 80s. But now, again, we have three companies, okay, all the way up there. So they do change the characteristics. So you do see a lot of analysis, you know, with the seven and without the seven. For example, yes, they are the biggest earners on there, but mm-hmm. when you look at the earnings to the PE and earnings to as a percentage of their market value, they're not contributing as much as some of the other companies, but they have a much higher impact on the index, those three companies, and seven, obviously.
So here's a loaded question. We'll come back, but as one of the inventors, one of the maybe the inventor, maybe a second in on market cap weighted indices, which, by the way, was not really investable by the average person for ever. It was only until I won't even say mutual funds, because it was really mutual funds were more actively traded, even though they were maybe more closet indexers for a long time. But the fact is, until the advent of the ETF, that was a true passive investment that started with, you know, SPY or any of the ones that were related.
It was Bogle from Vanguard, basically, who started it.
And that was mutual funds, too, in all fairness.
Yeah. Yes. And that's when it became investable to you and I as individuals or higher end individuals. Before that, it was the pension funds, insurance companies, the fourth estate. So it really is a new kind of a characteristic to go into indices. And as we were speaking a few moments ago, you know, before we got on the air, there's probably more ETFs and indices than there are stocks. I mean, at S&P, we do over 2 million different indices, almost everything you can think of.
2 million? 2 million?
2 million.
What does that mean?
They have private companies, public companies. It's not just the 500, but we have indices across the world. You want to go into technology issues in Greece as compared to the EU, ex-Greece or ex-the pigs, you know, Portugal, and those. You can do whatever you really need to do. So again, the combination available to people today is enormous, which makes it a lot harder.
Here's my loaded question to you. If we all are in agreement, the general investment community, we're all in agreement that it's tough, if not impossible, to beat the S&P 500, right? It's like kind of one of these things that if you do and you try, even if you match it and you charge a fee, you're a little bit under because of the fee. If the market cap weighted has been the flag bearer of the ultimate market investment, does that mean that Standard & Poor's is the best money manager in the world?
No, and I'll use the S&P 500 as the easy example here. The intent of the S&P 500, of the index, is to emulate the U.S. common domestic market higher end. We are not supposed to beat it. We're not supposed to underperform it. We are supposed to replicate it. And we do that by picking issues. So if semiconductors in the S&P 500 go up 4% and semiconductors in the general market only go up 2%, S&P did not beat the market. We didn't do our job. So we're emulating the market for better and worse. You know, we real estate, you know, still in the red so far, yet you have technology up over 30%. And it blends these how the how is the economy doing? And in general, the economy and the market have done well over decades. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Money managers go in to say, which is NVIDIA? Tomorrow's NVIDIA. Which should I bought the small caps the day before the consumer price index came up, before it made that 11% jump?
Right.
That is very hard to do. Only about 15% of the actual money managers beat the index in a given time period. So it's hard to do it because you've got to pick those winners. And just like baseball, hitting a home run, the hardest thing is the second home run in a row. You know, back to back doesn't happen too much. And in the indices, when we look at, money managers who beat the indices, back to back does not happen at all. You have ones that are better at it than others, but it's hard to beat the index because as a money manager, you have costs, you have salaries, you have taxes, you have exchange trading costs, okay, to do that, and execution. As an index, S&P could change the membership every single day, and it costs nothing. So you really have to do about 120, 130 basis points better than the index to match it.
Interestingly enough, you don't work for free, right?
No, we do not. S&P, the S&P 500, we make our money a multitude of ways, but in the indices, since we're talking about the S&P 500, we license it. We mentioned Vanguard, one of the original ones. You go to a Vanguard or a Fidelity or somebody, you want to buy the S&P 500, the technology, whatever the S&P is. We get a very, very small percentage of that money that's under there, like a license fee, assets under management. So as the market goes up, we make more money on there. When the market goes down, we make less. And since we're talking about the S&P 500, we are a little over $47 trillion in market value. And of that $47 trillion, about 17.5%, over $8 trillion is indexed to the 500. Hmm. So that is a big portfolio that goes with the S&P 500. 17% of those companies, are licensed. So if an issue is put in or the weighting is changed, you get a tailwind in the market.
It would seem to me that you would put in some arbitrary or some small accounting fee in there so that you can say that this, because you're trying to emulate what the real market is and what the world is, but it's not really investable unless it's totally free to do. And there's commissions and there's turnover and all that. So how come you've never utilized an S&P 500, well, maybe out of the 2 million you do, but an S&P 500 market cap weighted with real commission-based assumptions?
Because there's different cost factors. We mentioned Vanguard, and I think I mentioned Fidelity when we were talking just a second ago. They have two different cost factors for what it costs them to execute, for what it costs them to do. We say that the S&P 500 did, let's say, 10% for a certain time period. And these companies come back and say, we did 9.8 and 9.4. They had almost the same execution, almost the same portfolios, but their costs are different. So we would have to make an arbitrary number to say, okay, we did 10% and using the average cost, and where would you do it? Would you do it based on exchange trades? Would you base it on taxes? Would I also subtract out costs if I was doing an income tax situation? We have indices that take out taxes when you get them on dividends, but each country is different. And in the U.S., as each state is different. They said New York goes up to 14%, Florida has zero income tax.
So here's the point, and I want to talk about this. The reality, if listeners now take this to heart, I think the reality, I think, Howard, you'll agree with this, that the S&P as a benchmark is not an absolute. It can be used for guidance, right? But the fact is there's really no way for anybody still to purely invest in the S&P at a zero cost. So the opportunity to beat the S&P 500 by investing in the S&P 500, if you're following me here, is highly unlikely because you're always going to have some kind of...
If you buy a fund, a licensed fund that follows exactly what the index does, for better or worse, okay, they have costs, and you are going to underperform the S&P 500. Okay, there are emulators out there, and we think there are more emulators out there than there are actually licensed people, who typically will buy 70% of the index directly, indirectly, through repos, different kinds of instruments. And with that 30%, they will try to beat the index and cover the costs. Okay. And that could be an institution doing it. It could be you or I, you know, in our garage. You know, again, it's hard to beat the index because there are costs involved.
Right.
And those are known items, and all the funds and ETFs that put them out, they put out how much it is and how much their costs are. But again, beating the index directly, not getting close to it, beating it, you know, means you have to make up for all those costs, like anything else.
So as a result, here's my point to all this, to everybody listening, that take down your expectations a little bit. You know, I mean, you know, the fact is everybody's always looking for that holy grail of I'm going to beat the market. That's not necessarily the game to play. The game to play is to have a reasonable amount of risk to get a good return commensurate with your particular risk tolerance and time horizon. And if that means that you want to be in the index, well, okay, fine. Be in the index. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Or an index or an mixture of them or something of that nature. But anyway, Howard, I want to talk to you about switch gears here and talk about I want to talk about earnings, because I know you pay a lot of attention to that, because when I get your earnings information, it's pretty fascinating. But hang on a second. I want to do a quick break, and we'll come back. I want to talk about earnings. I want to talk about the magical number of companies' percentage of how many beat almost every single quarter. Going back, I think it's 37 out of the last 40 quarters this happened. So hang on one second. So let's take a second and talk about something really cool. I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next-generation trading platform. Built from the ground up, IBKR Desktop combines their powerful features with a unique set of groundbreaking tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, IBKR Desktop redefines what you can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. Download IBKR Desktop at IBKR.com/desktop. That's IBKR.com/desktop. All right, we're here with Howard Silverblatt from S&P. What is it? S&P Dow Jones Indices, right? That's the full gamut.
That's the full name. We are S&P 500, but we're also Dow Jones Industrials.
Yeah, you got it covered.
You get to the 40,000.
Do you have you look at these as you're like kind of children. Do you have a preference of the calculation methodology, just to finish off what we were talking about before the break, of the Dow Jones from a price weighted standpoint, or for the rest of the major indices that are market cap?
Well, I think mine and most of the people on the street would probably agree with me. And we can see this because of how much is invested in it. The S&P 500 market weight seems to be the preferred way to do it and the way to account for it. That is a preference I have. The Dow is not an index that you would start price weighting today. It's 1896. It's over 120 years old. It was instrumental back then. However, that said, even with all its archaic math, okay, over time, the Dow and the S&P correlate pretty well. Over short time periods, not at all, okay? And it's not the way you would do an index today. But when you talk about the Dow and when you listen to the media and when you talk to people on the street, not necessarily professionals, but just, you know, one-on-one with friends and relatives and stuff, they know the Dow. They can name some of the issues. If you name the issues in the Dow, they could tell you what they do. And they understand it. You take the companies and you average them out. It is a simplistic way to understand, but it correlates really well with a much more complicated market cap instrument, such as the 500.
Yep.
So it's not that it's a favorite, but the Dow gets great press and it's where you lead off the day.
Professionals
usually use the 500.
Do you think it's time to take off the word industrials?
No. the old saying of paper, do no harm. This thing has worked for so long in spite of.
Can't just call it the Dow Jones 30. Just call it the Dow Jones 30.
That's right. Well, it's called the industrials from the older days. Again, there are no real estate issues in there. There are no utilities in there. Okay, it's only one materials. Okay, as a matter of fact of that, you know, but. It is the old industrial.
Who's the one materials?
It's saying that.
Who's the materials?
Oh.
I mean, Alcoa is not in there. They threw Alcoa out.
No. Oh, it's Dow. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dow Chemical. Yeah.
It used to be DuPont, Dow DuPont, and then they merged and then they did the distribution, and it's Dow. They're the one. And they're a relatively small. Remember that in the Dow, you're price weighted. Okay, so $1 moving up or one down has about a 6.55, 6.5 points. So if Dow goes up a dollar, that the S&P Dow Jones Industrial gets 6.5 points higher. But on a dollar value of the stock, there's a total difference in price for the Dow, the company as compared to its, because it's a $55 stock compared to, let's say, United Health. United Health, if it went up 1%, that would be about $5.7. And that would be 37 points. As a matter of fact, a while ago, remember, a week ago or so, when United Health, which is the heaviest issue in the Dow Jones, went up, it took the Dow up about 375 points.
That's interesting. Okay. And I find it fascinating because you see companies like Apple. Apple specifically did as the way I see it at least, they specifically did a split. And one of the reasons was that everybody was speculating that they wanted to be in the Dow.
Yes. And that's been spoken about. And I'll give you a stat that will back that up. But Apple, which is, and Microsoft, which are the largest companies, they are not the largest in the Dow.
Right.
The Goldman Sachs, as a matter of fact, is the NVIDIA of the Dow. They added about 24% of the return year to date. Goldman Sachs did, so they're the equivalent of NVIDIA in the 500. But the Dow, since it's price weighted, if we were to add, when I say we, I mean S&P, Berkshire Hathaway, not the baby one, but
the big boy.
One that's several hundred thousand. Okay, and make it the Dow 31. I don't care. Take out whatever you want to add. So you have the Dow there, and that next day, the other 30 companies go down to zero. And Berkshire Hathaway goes up 5%.
Yeah.
Newspaper says Dow goes up because it's price weighted.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's the pluses and minuses. So, yes, to answer your question, it does make it difficult to add an issue mathematically. That is very high or very low on the price. You get something that's a $30 stock when the average is about 180, that whole thing can go under and not impact as much as a higher price issue going up 10%. Again, you need to know the index, whether you're buying a Dow, the S&P, you're buying a dividend, a yielder, an earnings growth, which is where we got onto this is with earnings. And there are earnings indices, by the way.
So let's talk about the 77 to 78% of magical companies that beat earnings estimates quarter after quarter after quarter. Maybe I'm a little too tight. I'm going to go 75 to 78%. Just let's spread out a little bit. Okay? It's
historically about 71. Not a bad ratio.
Right. So how do we get there? How do we get there though? How does that happen? Tell me the inside scoop on this.
Are you sitting? Because I don't want you to be shocked and fall over.
No. I want my listeners to. I kind of know, but I want my listeners to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Okay, most of the estimates, first of all, it's based on projections, and it's bottom up. So you're looking at each one of the companies and say, okay, we think IBM's going to make so much. And when I say we, I mean the analytical community. So you go into the 40 analysts that are covering IBM. And you're saying, what do they make? And you get 40 numbers and you put them through some statistical tests, make sure they're all including and excluding it. But that is weighted very heavily towards sell side analysts. And this is why I want you to be sitting. Sell side analysts do seem to be a bit more optimistic, especially when you're selling something. Your product is always good.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers do have a habit of being optimistic. So if I look at where it's expected to be in a year from now, a year and a half, typically that number will decline as you get closer to reality. Also, companies have a habit of managing investors. I think I'm going to make 8% next year of growth, another 2% from buyback. So I have a 10% EPS increase coming down. Let's not put out 10%. Let's put out a range. Okay. So just in case we don't make it. Okay. Again, they're not changing the facts, but they're giving a range because there are variables. So the numbers going forward very often are very optimistic. So you get a high beat rate. You would much rather beat and let your stock go up a little than if you don't beat, your stock takes a beating. So the numbers very often are optimistic going forward.
What do you think is a truer
on the bottom up? What, you know, bottom up.
What do you think is a truer number? Earnings or revenue?
Okay, this quarter we're going to make, you know, for the second quarter, it looks like we're going to make a new record on operating earnings, okay?
And what is that? What is that going to be? What is the estimate per share on the S&P?
About 5780. Okay, that's up about almost 6%, 5.8% from the prior quarter.
That's the revenues.
Oh, no, that's the sales.
The sales,
that's
right.
The earnings. $57 on the sales, which is about $465. We're down from last quarter,
right?
And we're down off our high. The result being that, and this is a key item, which is also helping the market, is that margins are supposed to be over 12% this quarter. 12% on your net.
Which is unbelievable, by the way, which is unbelievable considering higher price and all that.
Yes. Well, people have the money and they're spending again. Yep. When those retail and the CPI numbers came out, I mean, you know, we are in America and we believe in spending. Having the money or not having the money is a different story. the historical margin is about 8.9%, and we are at 12%. Over 12% now. We'll see how we'll end up. The tail end of the quarter probably brings it down to the low 12s, you know, because retail does not have a high margin. But
which is amazing. That's an amazing number.
It is. And even if we lose it, and it, by the way, it was 2020, right after COVID, when you had all that spending, that we had numbers in the 13.5. I think the high was 13.54. And that was in the second quarter.
And let's not forget also lower corporate taxes didn't hurt that margin number.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, if you get that earnings file, then you notice I do put in the tax rates. The effective tax rate for Q1 2024 was 20.15% for the S&P 500 on a dollar value. 20% was the tax rate. Okay, mm-hmm. You go back to let's say 10 years, Q1 2014, which was before the tax reduction, it was 29.7. That's an enormous difference. And I should comment or at least throw in the difficulties we're going to have, that a lot of the tax changes 2025 expire, and it is going to be a major issue no matter who is in, no matter who's in control of the House, the Senate, the White House. It is a major tax legislation year 2025 with over $6 trillion in taxes credits coming up,
which so, by the way the government could use that money back.
They could if interest rates decline, it will help, but the amount of money that we are paying now is about 15.5% on interest, you know, compared to our income, and that's a dangerous number. I mean, it is costly. Think of paying, you know, a sixth of your income on interest on your debt. That digs into everything else.
So just to back up on the quarter, we got 50 and change on the quarterly, on the operating earnings. What are we talking about for the annualized or for the year?
For the year, most of that is still going to be an estimate. Okay.
Yeah.
We're looking at about 239, which at, right now would give you about a 23 PE, which yes, that is
high.
Yeah, it's definitely historically high. And if you wanted to look at 2025, we have a $276 estimate. Most of the streets are a little bit higher than us, but we're within, you know, the means. The 276 gives you a PE of 20. You are paying a 20 PE on expected growth for a year and a half from now. That number should be historically more like 16. So we are optimistic. We expect a lot of growth. And we are paying for the growth.
Now, what when you strip out my numbers that I looked at is somewhere about 16.5. If we strip out the if we look at an average weight, you know, if we strip out the market cap component, the average weighted S&P 500 is about a 16.5 forward. Is that about right in your mind?
I haven't run it recently because it's totally different now into what you know, the concepts that we're using. But yeah, that would be probably then maybe the high 15s. I did some work last year, you know, going on numbers.
I think it's important to look at those two. I always like to look at those two to see, you know, where is the earnings coming from, right? I mean, we know that the expectations are very high for the top end.
Yes, we do, and I actually put out a quarterly, you know, when at the end of each quarter, which digests the earnings and says, okay, this came from this, this came from that. And the ratios that we usually look at is how much is your market value and how much are your earnings? I'm 1% of the market value, but only 0.5% of the earnings. That's not a good number.
Right.
When you look through that, a lot of these higher-end Mag 7 companies are not pulling their weight in earnings. Okay, but that's because the earnings I'm looking at are yesterday's, you know, the quarter that just ended. When you move it forward, or sense statistically, and with the rationale again being, I am paying for tomorrow's earnings because I can't buy a stock from yesterday. I can only buy it going forward. So we are paying that 20 PE, I said, in general, 2025 for the S&P, it's a lot higher when you look at those higher-end issues, growth stocks, you know, especially on the Mag 7.
So I've seen your spreadsheets. I've seen the work you've done. Obviously, the things that you provide to me are the final products. There's a lot more that goes into that. Tell me this, if you can, if you will. How much AI help more recently have you been delving into for some of this?
A lot. And it's not just myself. I've seen them at other brokerage. I've seen them at brokerage houses. I shouldn't say other brokerage houses because S&P doesn't sell stocks. But I've seen them at brokerage houses. I've seen them in insurance. Okay. It's not the AI of artificial intelligence the way we see it in on TV, but it is better computing. I can only, and I probably sound excited because I am about it because I've seen it and I'm using it. It is better computing. I can connect more dots. Similar to like when PCs came out, okay, and all of a sudden I didn't have to add up numbers or go to a staff person and do that. You could do it much quicker and connect. So the AI is helping in an enormous amount of things. Do you still have to check every piece? Yes, but I could put something through and get it back in a couple of hours that would have taken me a week. And yes, I would have made that same statement 40 years ago, 30 years ago when I had a PC, you know, when you were going for the single disc, dual disc, ATs, advanced technologies, you know. This is a revolutionary item. And where I see it being used right now, not just in S&P, but other houses downtown in the city, okay, and insurance companies as well, is that it enhances your computations and your ability to correlate things. You still need to think about it,
right?
Yes, but I'm getting things, and you can limit it because one of the biggest difficulties that we've seen is that you get misinformation. You can limit it. So I can go in with AI and say, only look at SEC documents. and correlate, and only then look at company filings and do that, and then compare the two. Then go into equity analyst estimates and stuff and compare and show me the variance. I mean, that is a lot of work. So the AI is helping everywhere, and it's an enormous difference.
I'm going to speculate. I'm going to take a leap here, but I'm going to say that I bet maybe now or in your day, you were really good on a 10 key.
Hey, I still use some of my software is still from the 80s.
You don't, did you used to have one of those calculators that had the roll that was?
Oh yes. I remember as a kid using one that you had the
handle
shank. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. My father was an accountant.
My grandfather had one of those.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Again, and those were revolutionary. You didn't have to add them up and then have somebody else do it and then cross-foot something.
Yep.
And then PCs, spreadsheets.
Right.
Excel, Lotus 1, 2, 3. And this AI is the next step in there. Yeah. It's not artificial intelligence in the way that it sounds, but it is an enormous enhancement on calculating and doing correlations. But I don't think true AI will be in my lifetime.
I like your definition of better computing. Very simple. Better computing. That makes a lot more sense because my thinking of this and what I've seen so far is a lot of long away, maybe possibly we'll see kind of thing. Whereas the reality is it looks like they cleaned up the processing and the computing power to make it so it's a much smoother and a much more elegant, like you said, more connected, more intuitive
process. It is used on a regular basis in the financial world. Again, insurance, finance, brokerages, it is used. Maybe not in a glorified way that, you know, it's thinking, but it enhances and helps.
Yeah.
And that's going to, one of the concerns, and I believe it's there, it's going to cost jobs. It's going to change jobs. Some jobs are not going to be needed. Other jobs will be needed. There's change on there. Again, I get stuff in a couple of hours that took a lot longer to do. Some of it I did, some of it other people did. Well, as that goes through, some positions are not going to be there, but they're going to be new ones.
Yep. Now, you talked about float. You mentioned the word float, and you said we're not going to go there, but I'm going to talk about something else. Every single time we have you on, I think we talk about this, but one of the reasons that we've seen the operating earnings, which does in fact take into consideration number of shares divided by earnings, right? You know, actual earnings.
Right.
Is the impact of, and you see this firsthand, because you have to plug this in all the time, is the impact of share buybacks. We saw that Apple recently did a small, relatively insignificant $110 billion buyback, which you may say, well, it's only at this point 3% of the company or something like that, right? But that's a lot of money to spread around. And companies have become very accustomed to doing this. How is that goosing? In what percentage do you see the actual earnings on a regular basis for companies?
Okay. First of all, Apple, that's the announcement. Apple did last quarter, we don't know this quarter yet, about $23 billion. They did about $89 billion for the last 12 months, and that was through Q1 because, again, I don't have Q2. I mean, I have estimates, but the facts. Companies on their buybacks definitely help their EPS. You have the same earnings, and you're reducing the share count. But shares are also a lot more expensive, okay? So what we look at to see how the buybacks are impacting is the percentage of companies that have done significant share count reductions. Again, if I buy back a million, but I issue 750,000, I'm looking at the net number. Because when I go to take that $1 million income divided by shares, so you use share count. Okay, for the first quarter of this year, about 14% of the companies reduced their share count by at least 4%. And we think 4% is a significant number because
that's big. That's enormous.
That means my earnings per share went up at least 4%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
without doing anything, by the way, let's be clear, without doing anything.
That's correct. So if I have $1 million income and 1 million shares, divided by 1 million shares, $1 EPS, right? Mm-hmm. If I have the same million, same cash flow, exactly 1 million, but I bought back 4% of my shares, so it's 960. 1 million divided by the 960,000, all of a sudden I have $1.04 earnings. My PE is lower. Gee, all of a sudden I'm a growth company. I'm growing quicker.
Right.
Okay. It changes everything. And we found that we did back testing, about 4% makes the difference. I actually came out to about 3.7 and change, you know, with UITs, funds, we can make different decisions on PEs and earnings. So wasn't going with 3.7. We used 4%. So again, 14% of the companies, basically, the last quarter did that. That is down from well over 20%, okay, as an example, in 2019, or 25% at the beginning of 2019. That was 1 in 4. The reason this has gone down is because shares have gone up, and it's so expensive to buy shares back, but they are still having an impact. 1 in 7 companies, you need to realize, have at least a 4% buyback impact. So you are paying that high premium, not on growth, but on that. And that's an important item on there. By the way, we do expect the buyback tax to go up probably next year.
And then how's that going to, what's happening then?
Well, right now it's 1% of your net buybacks. And that's impacted operating earnings by about a little less than half a percentage point. So it really hasn't impacted companies' ability to do buybacks on there. Yes, it went from zero to costing you half a percentage point. Okay, so that's an enormous change, but a half a point wasn't stopping anyone from doing buybacks. And the government knows this, and when it was voted in, it was voted by both Democrats and Republicans. It was seen as an easy way to get money. Biden's twice called for 4% buybacks, and we see it across the board that it's still on the table. So we would expect buybacks to somehow be increased, whether they redefine it or retax it, however the wording goes, that it costs companies more. We think the danger area is about 2.25% to 2.5%. Anything over that tax rate, and again, it's currently 1%. Anything over that, about 2.5% is going to impact companies in general, whether they're doing buybacks or not. And what we would expect to see is that they would shift some of the buyback monies to dividends, but not dollar for dollar. Because a buyback, I could turn on and off at any point.
Yeah, you don't want to reduce a dividend. Oh, no.
Right. A dividend, yeah. I cut the dividend. It's history. I mean,
yeah.
If you find a justifiable reason for that, nobody has yet. So again, so about a 2.5% increase. And as government starts looking for more and more money, and again, we'll have a new Congress coming in. Don't know the makeup of anything, but both Democrats and Republicans appear to be willing to increase it. Maybe not to the 4% range, but definitely to increase it. So we expect it, and so does mostly everyone else on the street. It's just when it comes and how much.
Yeah. Lots going on. Howard Silverblatt, I appreciate you coming on and telling us all this good stuff and getting into the idea of float and buybacks and PE and outlook and market cap versus price weighted. There's so much information that you hold. So hopefully that you will continue on your career for a very, very long time. And maybe you and I can actually meet up in person again one of these days, been many years. And since you're only right up the block, and have some lunch or something, maybe a cocktail.
Yeah, the market closes at 4.
It does.
You know, done with trading and stuff. We set it up at 4:30. I'm ready.
Isn't there a Jimmy Buffett song about it? It's 4 o'clock somewhere.
I go by NYSE time.
I got you. All right. Thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
You take care.
All right. Thanks.
You have a good one.
And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. As I said, do yourself a favor. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out all there is that we do on a regular basis for people just like you, investors, managing money for their future, making sure that you are sound for you and your family for a long time. Thanks a lot for joining me. I'll see you again soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.